Gotta hit the power button.
All right. So, talking about House of Representatives. But I would like to take a step backwards to Monday, if I could. Because, ironically, shortly after we talked about filibustering, Democrat Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker, went on the floor and talked continuously for 25 hours and like 15 minutes.
Wasn't it like a record?
He beat the record that I had talked about on Monday that was held by Democrat Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. Now, here's the thing, though. I don't know how the political scientists are going to log this. Yes, he talked for a long time. And if you watch the end, I caught the end of it. He was punch drunk at the end. But I couldn't imagine what any of us would be after talking for 25 hours. But I don't know if it's technically a filibuster. And I say that because there was no pieces of legislation that was specifically being debated. It was a time when the floor was open, and he just simply took to the floor, as all members have a right to do, and started talking. Now, traditionally, filibusters, you don't have to talk about anything particular. So he went on and told Senator Booker, talking about his life story and his friends and all the rest, and that's fine. But again, technically speaking, it wasn't during the debate of a bill. So it's going to be interesting to see, but again, I don't really like his politics, but I have respect for anybody that's willing to go out and, you know, engage in a political stunt to get attention. And that's one of the things that's allowed in the Senate. The minority party has the ability to grab time to push their positions. And that's one of the things that I was always amazed that the Democrats, when they had the majority, were talking about ending the filibuster. You know, ultimately, that's a tool that the minority party can use. So hopefully the Democrats realize that what they were talking about when Biden was a president was stupid and just allow the filibuster to remain, because it's an interesting device, that's for sure. All right, the other thing is that I did submit your midterm grades. Your midterm grades are just simply the average of exam one and exam two. But of course, the total weight of exam one and exam two is only equal to 30% of your final average. So what does that mean? Well, we're going to take exam number three, and that's worth 15% of your average. You have to submit a paper, which is worth 20% of your average, and you're going to have a final exam in here that's worth 35% of your final average. So whatever your average is currently in your grade section for midterm, I don't even know how you can access that. I don't know what you see, but that only represents a snapshot. The other thing that did not take into consideration was attendance. As we know, the attendance policy for the class is if you end the semester with perfect attendance, you get bonus points. If you have more than four absences, you lose points. That was not factored in. But those four or five of you who submitted the extra credit assignment, I did add those points in. I liked all of them. Actually, four of you are here that submitted them. I read them all. I liked what you had to say. Very interesting. I liked your perspectives, and I appreciated that. So, as I said that, it wasn't going to be graded. You know, I wasn't going to penalize you. I just wanted to hear your thoughts. So I was very pleased with what, I mean, you all, interestingly enough, all the submissions went in slightly different directions, which was pretty interesting, but
that makes it less boring for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, like I said, and I really mean this sincerely, I'm probably one of the few, if only, professors you'll ever come across that I don't care what your opinion is. Not that I don't want to listen to it, but I'm not going to judge you based on your opinion. I want to hear what you have to say. And even if we don't align, I'm okay with that. It doesn't bother me. So I was very, very pleased with them. So thank you for those who put them in and for the effort. I will try to come up with a couple extra credit assignments as we go forward to the end of the semester. All right, so House of Representatives, bigger body, more rule-based. And as a result, it's more regimented. We talked about the differences between the House and the Senate. Of course, the biggest differences is the fact that there are more representatives, that they are selected or elected by districts. When we talk about elections, I'm going to reference the fact that the representatives are directly elected. So you go into the poll and you see a representative's name and you go and vote for him or her. You are giving a vote for that person. The districts, however, are apportioned based on population. So obviously the states that have the biggest populations have more representatives. But that's always changing due to the census. But the rules of the districts are controlled by the states. Gerrymandering, which we'll also talk about on elections. Oh, side note. Again, I've been very, very busy with selectmen stuff. But another interesting thing happened. There was a state, couple of state elections. Two districts in Florida to fill vacancies of Trump appointees. There also was a Supreme Court election in Wisconsin.
Has nationwide implications.
That does have nationwide implications because one of the issues that's raised is Wisconsin is going to be, there's a conflict over gerrymandering. So there could be a situation where a statewide election impacts national politics. So it's just interesting that the stuff that we're kind of talking about in here, it's playing out in real time. All right. As far as the leadership goes of the House, just like I don't really necessarily care if you remember who the leaders in the Senate are, same thing in the House in terms of their names. And of course, like the Senate, I didn't update these. These are from the last time I told the class, and there has been changes. But we got to at least know the offices. The Constitution creates the highest office in the House. And that position is referred to as the Speaker of the House. Now, interestingly enough, if you were paying attention during the Biden years, there were rumors out there that the Republicans, when they took control, were contemplating nominating Donald Trump, then out of office, to be the Speaker of the House. Legally speaking, that could happen. There is no requirement that the Speaker of the House be an actual member of the House of Representatives. Why did the Founding Fathers not put that in there? Well, they never thought in a million years anyone not in the House would be appointed to be the leader of the House. Because the leadership in the House is voted on by the members. But it's a possibility. It's never happened. But just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean someday it might. Who knows? But yes.
Do you have to throw your name into the running for leadership?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, let's say, this is kind of reverting to my question yesterday. If the Speaker of the House was a former United States president who already served the 4 years, and let's say both presidencies were, like, impeached.
22nd Amendment says, can't be elected.
That's one of the three ways. I heard a little, because I know we talked about it a little bit on Monday, but I heard a story about it yesterday. So, yeah, that could be a possibility. All right, so anyways,
all of the speakers, though, including former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and current Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, they were all elected by the body. After they were elected to the House of Representatives from their district. Now, in theory, the selection should be nonpartisan, but going all the way back to the earliest days, when the first two political parties appeared, whichever party had more representatives, they picked one of their own to be the leader. Now, the minority party could put one of their candidates forward. And if the majority party or some of the majority party switched sides across the aisle, you could have a situation where you had a minority party representative as speaker. But that's never happened. So that's the other tech, that's the other possibility. And there was talk about it, if you recall, Matt Gaetz essentially cooed the former Speaker of the House. He's out in California, can't remember his name. Because the House had no restrictions on how many representatives were necessary to basically do a vote challenging the speakership. So Matt Gaetz did it all by himself. And when that occurred, the prior speaker, I apologize, I don't remember his name, he goes on TV still. He's making mad bucks as being a consultant. But anyways, there was talk when there was like 3 or 4 or 5 ballots before Mike Johnson was selected, that some Democrats or some Republicans could switch side and join with the Democrats. There was talk about that. And yes, that could happen. But that's not the way it worked out. If the Speaker is allowed to fill out the entire congressional term on day one of the new term, the speakership has pretty much already been decided. Because what ends up happening in December, before the end of the year, the election year, the membership gets together, does informal polling, and then before they recess for Christmas, they typically vote for their leaders. So those are in place before the new Congress starts. Now the Speaker is not necessarily the most tenured member, but because they are a constitutionally recognized officer, they are the highest ranking member of the body. They are the presiding officer over the House. One of the most important duties they have, ceremonial speaking, is whenever the president goes and appears before a joint session, the Speaker of the House gets to sit up on the dais behind the president, side by side with the vice president. And as was mentioned, they are the second in line for the presidency if there's a vacancy. So POTUS dies, V. POTUS comes in. If V. POTUS dies, it goes to the Speaker. That's in the Constitution, by the way. Now, in terms of powers, unlike the President of the Senate, who really has no power other than casting the tie-breaking vote, the Speaker actually has tremendous powers. But the powers were given to the Speaker through the House rules. Typically, for example, the Speaker does not participate in debates. Typically, the Speaker does not vote on the floor. But if there's a tie, then the Speaker is the tie-breaking vote. But because we've never had a situation where there was a statistical tie in the House, there has never really been a need for a Speaker to actually vote. The Speaker recognizes the members on the floor to speak before the body. The Speaker has the final say on questions of procedure. So, go back to when Trump was giving the speech before the joint chambers. We had Green from Texas get up, started disrupting Speaker Johnson, enforced the rules of the chamber, gave the member three opportunities to sit down, to, you know, follow decorum. And when Representative Green continued, he called in the sergeant-at-arms and had him removed.
That's procedurally in the rules. Never happened before, but it's there. The speaker also has authority to delegate the presiding role.
So, just like in the Senate, where the presiding officer position is rotated, the same thing happens in the House. So if you put on C-SPAN on any given day, unless it's a big issue, typically you'll have a member from the majority party serving as the temporary presiding officer. Where the speaker's power is the most is those backdoor deals. The speaker can basically put forward an agenda and keep the membership in line by promising his consent or his support for committee appointments. The speaker also has the ability to select all of his junior officers. Thank you, I know, that was a good point. And, ultimately, because the House is divided on party, the speaker also serves as the de facto party leader. So, back when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, she publicly argued with George W. Bush over Iraq war policy. Former Speaker John Boehner battled in public on the media, on the TV, with Obama over Obama's spending and Obamacare. When Trump was in office and Pelosi came back as Speaker, she battled against Trump on the border wall funding and infrastructure. And she encouraged both impeachments. Mike Johnson today, most recently, not only is he talking about trying to secure Trump's agenda, but he's also gone out and he's helped campaign for other candidates to get office. Not only in the Senate, not only on the House, but he's also helped out in some gubernatorial situations as well. So ultimately what I'm saying is yes, the speaker is typically very, very, very partisan. Although there is no rule that they have to be. But ultimately, if you are in your office because of partisanship, you're kind of obligated to help the party out to make sure it can have a majority. And if for some reason you slip into the minority, then you got to try to get that majority back. Questions on any of those elements of the speaker? All right. Kevin McCarthy, that's the former speaker. Here he is, right there.
Duh.
In terms of the other officers, in many ways it's kind of similar to the Senate, but I do have a few other ones that other positions that are more noteworthy. Obviously, just like in the Senate side, you do have the majority and the minority party leaders. The current majority leader is Representative Steve Scalise. The current minority leader is Hakeem Jeffries. Not that you need to remember their names. What the majority and minority leaders do is they represent the parties on the floor, similar to what takes place in the Senate. So they implement strategy. They speak to the press. They keep membership in line. Now, typically what happens, regardless of the speakership, whoever the party selects as the majority leader will remain the leader of the party if after the election it switches that the majority is now the minority. So Pelosi was the majority leader until the Democrats lost the House in the midterms of 2018. So at that point, Pelosi went and became the minority leader. She then retired and Hakeem Jeffries was selected. And he will remain the minority leader so long as the party wants him. And in the event in this coming midterms, 2026, the Democrats retake the House, then he will be elevated.
Typically.
Assisting the majority and the minority leaders are the whips. Just like in the Senate, these are the goons, if you will, for the party. These are the guys and gals that are responsible for keeping all the membership in line, you know, making sure that the necessary backdoor deals are in place to ensure their support for legislation. The current majority whip is Representative Tom Emmer, and the current Democratic minority whip is Catherine Clark. I don't think the Republicans kept this. No, they did not. Nancy Pelosi, when she was last Speaker, she used her authority as Speaker in 2011 to create the position of the Assistant Speaker of the House. Now, interestingly enough, this position also technically served as the assistant party leader. But the Republicans have no equivalent. So this position remained in place so long as Pelosi was the Speaker. But after the midterms, when the Republicans took the House, the position was eliminated and it has not been restored. So this may come back if the Democrats get the majority, or maybe the next Democratic speaker doesn't want to have this position. This was at the purview of the speaker. There are also party conferences, the Democrats caucus, the Republicans conference. There are also policy committees, just like we talked about in the Senate. Basically sets national policy for their legislative agenda. But in the House, there is one more entity that has tremendous power that is not representatively speaking equal in the Senate. This is the first committee that I'm going to talk about, because we are going to talk about the committees a little bit. This is the House Rules Committee. The House Rules Committee. Even though this is a committee, it has as an entity almost as much power as the Speaker over the operations of the House of Representatives. The job of the House Rules Committee is to, I don't want to use rules so many times, so sets the schedule on floor debate. anything in terms of floor operations is regulated by the Rules Committee. Now, in the Senate, bills go right to the floor. So the moment they pass out of committee, they can go to the floor and all the members can take up and they can debate them. In the House, because time is restricted, when a bill gets reported out of a committee, it goes to the House Rules Committee. And they determine how much time is allowed for debate. So, maybe there's not enough time for debate. Well, it's the House Rules Committee that can basically put a rule on the bill that it must be debated by the committee of a whole. Or maybe the House Committee on Rules doesn't want to allow amendments to be attached to the bill. So we're only going to vote on the measure. That's determined by the Rules Committee. Or they can also determine if we are going to allow amendments or riders or attachments. Do they have to be germane to the bill? Do they have to be related to it? Or can you just tack on anything you want? Those decisions are held by the Rule Committee. The Rules Committee can also kill a bill. If the Rules Committee does not issue a ruling on a bill, no debate is allowed. And if there's no debate, the bill is dead. Obviously, this means the Rules Committee is highly partisan. The Speaker uses the Rules Committee to control the House. And it is the only committee that is not proportional to the body's membership. So, like most committees, if there are, say, 15 members, you got to look at whatever the proportional ratio is in the House. I think now the Republicans have 220 representatives and the Democrats have 215. So if it's a 15-member committee, it might be 8-7 or something like that. The Rules Committee, it's 2-1. The majority party holds 9 seats, and the minority party holds 4. So essentially this means whatever the majority party wants, that's what it's going to get. Now, one last little bit of irony. This rule that created this system was put into place in 1970. It was done as a way to counter the election of Richard Nixon. The irony was, is when it was put in, the Democrats had almost a supermajority in the House. And they assumed that they would continue to control the House forever. And they did, up until 1994. So since that occurred, the Democrats have tried changing the rules when they're in the minority party. But unlike in the Senate, because they're in the minority, don't have the ability to do so. So just like the nuclear option, this can help the majority party, but it can also definitely hinder the minority party. Questions? All right, well, we got the structure down. We understand it's bicameral. We understand there's a House and the Senate. We understand the differences. We understand the unique characteristics. We understand the leadership. What the hell does it do? Well, I'll be honest with you. Congress at work is weird. It has a split personality. Because it just doesn't do one thing. It actually kind of does multiple things. And sometimes actions in one of the areas of activity counters the activity in another. It's very bizarre. But all legislative bodies are. On one hand, it's supposed to be the lawmaking body. And they are entrusted with making laws and policy for the nation. But because Congress is run by majoritarianism, are the rules by the majority in any given time actually good for the nation as a whole? Or are they self-serving? They're also supposed to be a representative assembly. The intent is to lick the people, who technically are the senators and the representatives' constituents, with the national government. But do they really represent the people? There's been a tremendous number of political scientists who've written papers and engaged in debates, and no answer is 100%. Because ultimately what I figured out is it really depends upon the individual. Some elected members of Congress feel that their job is to literally be the delegates of the people who elected them. So, if you are elected as a Democrat by Democrat voters, you are going to go to Congress and push partisanship. Because those are the people who put you in office. Of course, this means you are going to ignore the people in your district who did not vote for you. So keep that in mind if you ever see members of Congress on TV and you listen to them engage, and the Democrats and Republicans do the same thing, engage in their partisan vitriol. Are they serving you? And do they have to? Because that's another game they play, and we'll talk about that when we get to elections. If you didn't vote for the candidate, do they actually have to do things for you? Don't know. But there are also elected members who try to serve as trustees. Not for the party, but maybe for their state. So they, while in Congress, attempt to achieve consensus. Do a little bit for your side, but at the same time, try to find compromise with the other. So, one of the members that come to my mind in recent months, which is shocking, is Fetterman, Senator Fetterman from Pennsylvania. He was elected by a base that believed he was extremely left-wing, progressive. But since he's been in the Senate, since he's been healing from his stroke, he is more often than not kind of like the voice of reason. He was one of the first senators to basically say that he would vote for all of Trump's nominees. Why? Because procedurally, historically, the Senate generally gave in and gave the president whoever they wanted. And of course, he was attacked by members of his own party. You had Chuck Schumer in the Senate vote for continuing resolution bill, attacked by the radical members of his party. Well, you know, sometimes you got to do the nation's work. Now, the irony is just because one person acts like that sometimes doesn't mean they always act like that. So, again, it's just you got to pay attention to who your congressmen are, who your senators are, and just kind of watch their behavior. Oh, by the way, because of that, that's one of the reasons why Congress as a whole tends to poll in terms of favorability lower than used car salesmen. So, what about this lawmaking thing? Well, ultimately, this is the primary job of members of Congress. They are supposed to pass laws, and they are very busy. Every term, there are more than 5,000 bills filed in the House, and over 3,000 bills filed in the Senate. Some bills are tiny, simple modifications to existing laws. Some bills create entire new government programs. I think the bill that gave rise to Obamacare was like 3,000 pages long. And it's the job of the members to go through those and vote on them. And on any given year, members could be expected in both chambers to vote upwards of 1,000 times. How do they do it? Well, truth be told, they have staff. Currently, there are over 16,000 staffers that work with Congress. And of course, the size of their staffs depend upon seniority and positions of leadership. But these are often young men and women go to like Georgetown University and get an internship. Of course, they're paid, but I don't think they get much more than $100,000, which sounds a lot, but then you have to factor in the cost of living of Northern Virginia. It's not cheap at all, so. But these men and women that go down there and do these jobs, they're the ones who read through all the bills. They're the ones who take notes. They're the ones who answer the constituents' phone calls. They're the ones who basically work with their boss to prepare him or her for whatever the day's activities are. You can frequently see the senior staffers when a committee hearing is going on, because you have the committee members sitting on the front row, and then in the seats right behind each are two or three very young-looking people. Those are that particular senator or representative staffers. And every now and then they'll reach down or they'll give them documents, just helping them out. Congress also has created professional staff agencies, offices that operate within Congress. One of the most important is the Congressional Research Service. The job of the CRS is to basically research issues that pertain to potential bills. So, if we're looking for an increase in spending for the military budget, the Pentagon will submit a proposal. It's the job of the CRS to look at the individual line items and see if those expenses are necessary. And just not say yay or nay, but just provide the data, which the members of Congress can then use in their debates. There is also the General Accounting Office. The job of the General Accounting Office is to conduct audits They audit all of the bureaucratic agencies. But they report to Congress. DOGE is the executive version, because that's what DOGE is doing. It's going through the books. Why? Well, the president cannot demand reports from GAO. GAO only goes to the House and the Senate. There is also the Office of Technology Assessment. Let's be honest, members of Congress are probably not tech gurus. Most of them could probably barely handle sending text messages. So the job of the OTA is basically to facilitate proper usage policies and procedures for government technology. Oh! The whole signals brouhaha. The only way government devices are allowed to have signal on it as a communication device is because the OTA authorized it. I don't know if you were paying attention a couple of weeks ago when Hexeth and all the ones were like testing.
Signal gate. Blame it on the staffer. Trump came out the other day. I was like, it was a Walsh staffer. It wasn't. It was him. But
oh, yeah.
Blame it on the staffer.
Well, if you're going to have people in your contact list, don't have initials. Actually have the person's
name. I think he tried to do it by voice. And he tried to add it by voice. And
I think so, too.
Just close enough that it got.
But I guess it was only in his phone as the initials.
Yeah.
So
it's just unfortunate. Yeah. He's a Green Beret. No better. Oh,
yeah.
Operational security.
Yeah, operation failure. Nope.
But it worked. I mean, we calmed the crap out of those Houthis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and at the end of the day, not a single American soldier died. So that's a win for me. All right, and the only reason why there are more, these are the ones that I've seen referred to in the newspapers. This one right here is the big one. Whenever there is a spending bill, a tax cut proposal, tariffs, it is the CBO that the Congress relies upon to crunch the numbers. The job of the CBO is to conduct studies on the costs of programs and the costs of proposals. So, I don't think the CBO has ushered or issued a report yet in terms of what's today, Liberation Day, I think that's how it was framed, where the administration is going to impose reciprocal tariffs, which I'm kind of in favor of, but I don't think CBO has issued a report on how it's going to impact, you know, the federal budget, but I'm sure that will be forthcoming. All right, so why do I put this in here? Well, just don't think that these people do it all themselves. They don't. All of the information that goes into drafting the bills are done by either agencies or staffers. Because again, if you listen to somebody like AOC, she's not a policy expert on anything. Or if you listen to former Representative Matt Gaetz or any of the people who become famous in Congress, they become famous by manipulating the media. But when you listen to them talk, none of them have PhDs from MIT or Harvard. So how do they know how to make a bill? They rely on the efforts of thousands of others. Questions? All right. How do bills get made? Well, there are two steps involved in the process. Step number one, there has to be authorization. So there must be a law crafted to create a program or a crime or a agency. Before a law can be enacted, there has to be a means of enforcing it. So typically, most bills, most laws, are assigned to existing agencies. But every now and then, something new happens and a new agency has to be created. So after 9/11, the Office of Homeland Security was created. And they basically took several different agencies and kind of put them under Homeland Security. So FBI, CIA, I think Coast Guard, I don't remember all the other agencies, but they're all just kind of like sandwiched in. Why? Well, at the time there was a belief that 9/11 occurred because all of the agencies weren't talking to one another. So if at least you could put them all under the same umbrella, you would force them to communicate. Of course, that hasn't necessarily worked, and I believe there's talk that they're going to eliminate Homeland Security, but we'll see. Then, once you authorize the new law, you have to have a means of paying for it. You need funds to implement it. Every single law must be funded financially in some way, shape, or form. Now, of course, this is controlled through the budget process. In theory, the president is supposed to propose the budget. The Congress is supposed to draft the budget, and the president's supposed to sign the budget. But going back to Obama, Congress has not passed the budget. They've continued operation through these continuing resolutions. So there is a lot of talk by Trump that he's going to actually try to push a budget, and it might be the first time in 15 years that that occurs. We'll see. Now, by the way, one way to get rid of an agency, cut funding in the budget. So I think that's what we're going to see with the Department of Education.
It's already happening.
I know. Yeah, I think that's how they're going to do away with it. They're just going to cut the funding. Because if there's no funding, you cannot have an agency. And if you don't have an agency, you can't enforce any of the rules.
Hey, here's something. It was just weird that it happened to me. I didn't believe it. We were talking in class a couple weeks ago about like the supply of gas is more expensive than the gas we consume and the heat of the house. So I don't use my heat much at the crib for nobody, right? And last month I got the bill. You know, I used, it was $180 for the bill for the month, right? It was $90 for the gas that I used and $110 to deliver it.
Isn't that insane?
I almost fell over. That's when I realized this stuff that don't really happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's all because of government regulations.
Crazy.
Yeah. All right. Well, how does a bill then become a law? Well, I would submit that you use your little YouTubes and look up Schoolhouse Rocks, how a bill becomes a law. Because that was how I learned it when I was like 8. And it's so accurate. Brilliant. It's so true. I think this figure comes from your book. I don't remember if I got this one from your book that I have, the open source book, or my previous book. Pretty sure it came from yours. And if so, if this is accurate, this is in chapter 11, figure 12. So essentially, how it goes is a bill is proposed. It's proposed by a rough draft being formally introduced in both chambers. Now, typically, it does not get introduced simultaneously. Typically, it gets filed initially in the House. If it's a spending bill, that's required by the Constitution. Or it may begin in the Senate. But shortly after it's submitted in one or the other, members of the other chamber reciprocate. once the bill is introduced, it's assigned to the various committees or subcommittees. In the committees, they hold hearings. They get experts that are for, that are against. And ultimately, they decide on whether or not they want to have this law. Now, one of the things that the committees are allowed to do is they're allowed to mark up the bills. And frequently, a bill that gets put into a committee when it comes out, if it gets voted in favor of, looks nothing like the way it entered. Then, once it's approved, if it passes out of the committee, of course, if it's in the Senate, it has to go right to the floor for debate. If it's in the House, it has to go to the Rules Committee first. But then it would end up on the floor, and members have a chance to debate. They can amend it. They can alter it. They can add to it. If... I'm trying to see where I am. Where am I at? Introduce committee work, debate, amend. I'm trying to think what I wanted to say there. Pass it by. All right, I don't exactly have that, but I know what all these things mean. If it's passed by the chambers, by a majority, it then, if it's financial, the financial impact of the law has to get added to the budget. Because again, any measure has to have funding. Of course, if there is no appropriation, there is no bill. It is also engrossed. Engrossment means it's put on the right stationery. There's certain forms, templates, that you have to use. But just because the bill is done doesn't mean it's done. Because the green represents what happens in the House. But lo and behold, look what we got here. We got the same activities going on in the Senate. Once it looks like it's going to pass the House, it goes to the Senate committees, where the Senate committees hold hearings. And they mark up, they alter, they tweak the bill. And then it goes to the Senate floor for debate and amendment. If the bill is passed in the House, and if the bill is passed in the debate, it then gets put on the calendar. It gets enrolled. Because there's one last important step that has to occur. And that occurs typically in the conference committee. A bill is passed in the House. A bill is passed in the Senate. What typically occurs is the bills are different. So in order for it to be voted on, the bills have to be merged. The House version and the Senate version must be combined, reconciled. That is done by the conference committee. The conference committee is made up of both representatives and senators. If the conference committee can create a final draft, it then goes to the floor of both chambers for final vote. You can't tweak it, though. You can't alter it. When it comes out of the conference committee, it is a yay or a nay. If it is a yay, the speaker signs it. The Senate president signs it. And then it goes to the president's desk. At that point, the president has a choice. If the president signs it, it becomes a law the moment the signature is affixed. If the president does not sign it, it becomes law if there are at least 10 days left in the session. If there are not 10 days left in the session, the bill dies through what is known as a pocket veto. Another outcome, the president could veto it. But a veto is just not a no. A veto technically is referred to as a qualified negative veto. Meaning, the president must say why they vetoed it. And by the way, presidential veto is all or nothing. The president can't use a line item veto. But just because the president vetoes the bill doesn't mean it's dead. No, 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 no. The qualified negative veto. Now, if it's pocket vetoed, it's dead. But if it's a qualified negative veto, it goes back to the Congress. And if both chambers, by a two-thirds majority, vote to overrule the veto, it can then become law. But of course, just because a bill comes to law, doesn't mean the Supreme Court, with judicial review, cannot strike it down and declaring it unconstitutional. But in a nutshell, that's how a bill potentially becomes a law. It's all explained in your book. You can Google it and find all the steps. You can also go back and listen to it. I made it as simple as I could. Why am I telling you this? You've had two exams. There are essay questions. Something like this might make a hell of a great essay question. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Know what I mean? All right. Last but not least, Congress are the committees. Now, President Woodrow Wilson, Democrat from New Jersey, once said, and I quote, "When Congress is in session, Congress is on display. Congress in committee is Congress at work." If you put on the C-SPANs, and there is debate going on in the floor, again, literally, every single member of that chamber is simply trying to get FaceTime. FaceTime that they can use social media, record little clips, and put on their advertising. They're engaged in the pageantry. But when they're meeting in Congress, I mean committees, that's when they're really doing the work. Now, I'm not going to make you learn all of the committees. But again, and I'm pretty sure these figures are from your book. I think I did update them. The last time I taught the class, I used the previous version of your textbook that you can get on my website or in Blackboard. It shows you the breakdown of all the committees. We don't have to remember them all. Just know that a standing committee is a committee that's permanent. It's always in operation. When last I looked at this, there were 20 permanent House committees and 16 permanent Senate committees. And if you look at the table in your book, you'll see that each committee deals with a broad area of policy. So, for instance, there is the Committee on Military Matters that deals with, like, Veterans Affairs. There's a Committee on Finances. There's a Judicial Committee. Each committee name clearly shows you what area of legislation they deal with. But the confusing thing is that each committee also has subcommittees. So while the standing committee might deal with the broad subject area, typically what happens is if a bill gets reported to a committee, it then gets re-reported to a subcommittee. And it's in the subcommittees where you have specialization. So, for example, the Armed Services Committee has 7 subcommittees. One on military readiness, one on global terrorism, one on veterans affairs, and so forth. You don't have to remember the difference. You don't have to remember the number. Just remember that standing committees are permanent committees. A standing committee is different than a select committee. Select committees are temporary. And they are created for investigation of particular matters. So, Lo pains me to say it, but an example that you may be aware of was the J6 committee. That was a select committee tasked with investigating the events around January 6, 2021. It operated for a period of time, and when it concluded its investigation, the committee essentially ceased to be. There were many, many famous select committees in U.S. history. There was the 9/11 committee, commission, I remember that one. There was the commission that investigated the assassination of JFK. Oh my God, I'm still learning. I haven't gone through all the documents yet, but I keep reading. I'm like, mind blown. But again, these committees are created, investigate, issue a report, and then it's done. I don't know if either chamber has any select committees currently in operation. I don't know. There are also joint committees. Joint committees. There are 4 permanent joint committees. And obviously, it's in the name. You have members of the House and members of the Senate that sit on these committees jointly. Not that you need to remember them. But there is the Joint Committee on Printing, which is in charge of overseeing all publications that come out of Congress. There is a Joint Committee on Taxation, which again is supposed to study the impacts of proposed tax legislation. There is the Joint Committee for the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress is one of the greatest archives in the history of human civilization. They capture everything. They capture records and CDs and songs and books and newspapers, pictures. Everything is recorded by the Library of Congress. And of course, there's a Joint Committee on Economic Matters. And then last but not least, as I said, when a bill becomes a law, in order to blend the House bill with the Senate bill, that's the job of the Conference Committee. Conference committees are created when a bill passes out of both chambers, and it lasts so long as reconciliation takes place. Sometimes it's a day, sometimes it's a week.
Can you repeat that for me, please?
Conference committee?
Yeah.
It brings the House version and the Senate version of a bill and blends them to one.
And it's made when what?
When a bill passes out of both chambers.
Okay.
And again, there's no timetable. They work as long as it takes to get it done.
I think there was one conference committee that met last year. I think they met for 5 minutes.
Because there was only like two significant differences between the House and the Senate version.
All right. Who sits on the committees? Oh, we have to bring back partisanship again.
The ranking member, sorry, stop that, not the ranking member, the chair of each committee is a member of the majority party. The chair is assisted by the ranking member, who is a representative of the minority party.
The rest of the membership are based on proportional representation. So, back when I last updated my stats here, when the Democrats were in charge, so this had to be, I think I did it right after the 2020 election. So this had to be 2021. The House, the Democrats had a slight majority. So at the time it was 50.9% versus 49.1%. So the example that I have on here is the Agricultural Committee. So to make that number, there were 26 Democrats and 21 Republicans. But the Senate at the time, it was a tie, 50-50. So you had equal members, but the chairman, who was from the party of the president, so it would have been a Democrat, because remember, Kamala Harris would have been the 51, tie-breaking vote. So the chairman of every single committee was a Democrat. And because there was a tie, the chairman was allowed to vote. Generally speaking, under Robert rules, the chairman of any committee does not vote unless there's a tie. So, what's the makeup now? Well, I better get off my butt and I better update this because I think I'm teaching this class next semester. Questions? All right. Last but not least, what about procedures? Well, most of the business of the standing committees deal with legislation. And many of the bills get kept in committee for a long time. As I said, bill comes into the committee, and often it's shifted down to a subcommittee. At the subcommittee level, they hold hearings. They mark up the bill. They change the wording. That could take weeks. And then once it's done in subcommittee, it then goes bumped up to the general committee, which then holds hearings and marks up the bill. And as I said, often when the bill gets reported out, if it gets reported out, it looks nothing like it did when it came in. In order for the bill to go to the next step, there we go,
it has to get a majority vote.
If a bill gets a majority vote in the committee, the technical phrase is reported out favorably. Now, just because the committee approves it, it still doesn't mean it's going to get approved when it hits the chamber.
It could still die. It still has a long way to go. And in fact, in Schoolhouse Rock, there's a scene where poor Mr. Bill is sitting in the hallway because the committee members are going blah, 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 and then it goes to the leadership and they're going blah, 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 blah. It shows it in the cartoon. It's the truth. Now, I will say that even though it takes forever, you know, the rules of Congress are not stupid. In the event of an emergency, you can bypass the committee process. That's done with a discharge petition. Essentially, the majority party decides as a party the bill's not going to committee. That the bill is going right to the House floor or right to the Senate floor. But it rarely occurs. Because as I said, most members of Congress, generally speaking, are dumb. They don't know everything, even though they pretend to. So the last thing they want to do is do what John Kerry did when he was running for president in 2004. When he was in the U.S. Senate representing the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, John Kerry, who became famous as an anti-Vietnam War protester, voted in favor of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Everything was good for the first year or two, but then popularity in the war began to wane. He decided to run for president, and he wanted to make an issue out of it. So the reporters, back when reporters kind of asked tough questions to both sides, a reporter, I think from the New York Times, it might have been ABC or whatever, literally asked John Kerry, wait, Senator, you are currently attacking President Bush because of the Iraq war. Well, Senator, when you were in the Senate, did you not vote for it? And Kerry said something along the lines of, yeah, I was for the war before I was against it. That's kind of a hint that the devil is always in the details. And he didn't give it much thought. He quickly raced out there to vote for it. Well, most members of Congress generally don't want to do that because they have to come home to their constituents. So it's very, very, very rare that discharge petitions are actually voted on and approved. If you want to talk about bipartisanship, typically it's a bipartisan effort to kill these petitions because members of both parties want them to go through the committee process. Now, it's very rare, I got two clicks, I'm watching the time. It's very rare that committees attack one another. When they're on MSNBC or Fox News, they attack one another all the time. But when they're actually in the committees, it's very, very rare that the Judiciary Committee takes a snipe at the Armed Service Committee. And even within the committee hearings, generally, there's a sense of decorum. For instance, members are not allowed to engage in ad hominem attacks. But every now and then, if you watch the C-SPANs, there are members that want to get a little extra attention, and they do crazy things. Like Marjorie Taylor Greene, in one hearing last year, held up pictures that came off of Hunter Biden's laptop showing his junk. Very inappropriate for a congressional hearing. But she did it for FaceTime. And then AOC reciprocated by doing something against Donald Trump. It was just childish, but it is what it is. And last but not least, Congress is also supposed to investigate and provide oversight. They're supposed to make sure that the government agencies are doing what the law says and not wasting money. We know how that's going. All right, questions?
All right. So is DOGE Congress?
Executive branch, White House. Okay. So basically, DOGE is essentially doing the job that Congress should have been doing all along.
Okay.
All right, so
We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the presidency of the United States. This topic, I kind of talk broadly speaking with the executive branch, with the president. I'm really going to go hardcore Constitution because I think it's very good for us to know what actually the president should do as opposed to how we may perceive the president. So that's coming up next. Papers. Oh, you missed the deadline for the extra points on the papers. That was Monday. But one person got it in, so I'm very excited. I can't wait for a chance to read that paper. But your papers are going to be due soon. I don't remember the exact date, but I'm pretty sure it's toward the end of April. April? I thought it was April.
May
2nd? I let it go that long. Wow, I'm nice. Five papers coming up due. And last but not least, like I said, on the midterms, your midterm grade is not really your half grade. It's only a third grade because exams one and two are only worth 30%. And all that is an average of exam number one and exam number two. So nothing to worry about. All right?
I didn't see my exam grade posted on Blackboard yet. Is that?
No. All right. We'll have to take the damn. Oh, actually, I got a question. You can answer this for me. Yeah. Could you see the exams?
No.
The first
no.
exam? You couldn't see the... You couldn't see the exams. You only could see the grade.
Correct.
Shit. All right. I got to figure out how to do that.
I was going to ask about that.
All right. Well, then, in that case, what I'll do is then I will post the grades, I guess, for exam number two.
Okay.
Because they're done. They've been done for a week. So. All right.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yeah. Toodaloo.